Okay, thank you, Steph. Thank you everyone for coming to the last talk of the day. I'll be talking mostly about a quantum Monte Carlo study we did of the Rydberg phase diagram. And as Steph also mentioned, this talk was originally part of my master's defense last week, last Friday. So this talk is a little spontaneous. And so I sat down on Friday and thought I should think through how this talk relates to the conference. And I thought that's also relevant to you, so I put it in. Firstly, does it involve machine learning? No, it does not. But it definitely involves quantum many-body physics, so I hope you'll get something out of it. Instead of machine learning, the techniques that we used were quantum Monte Carlo, specifically a type called stochastic series expansion. There I wanted to point out that the main code for that quantum Monte Carlo was written by Ijaz and Isaac from our research group. Ijaz is notoriously hard to capture on camera, but he is in the room. So if you want to go talk with him or find out what he looks like, he's here. And then also on the first slide, I already mentioned that this is also based on an internship I did with Quera Computing in Boston. I had a great time there last fall. And so I took that quantum Monte Carlo code and kind of put it into an open source package that you can now use to run those simulations. And the quantum many-body physics that we're now doing with it, that's a continuing collaboration with people at Quera, in particular Milan and Feng Li. And finally, I hope I get round to it, I've thrown in a bit of experimental data as well from Quera's new 256-qubit quantum processor, Aquila. And yeah, thanks to Feng Li and Jonathan from Quera for providing that data. Okay, having said that, wanted to start off with something very simple, something that perhaps was more relevant to point out to folks outside of this research field last week, but I still wanted to emphasize it. You know, this second quantum revolution is being largely powered not just by theoretical understanding, but the quantum control that experimentalists have achieved down to the level of single atoms. So, just a big shout out to those people. I've brought a photo of three friends from Quera, Nikki, Julian, and Connor, building a quantum processor. I've tried to match it with this diagram here on the right. You can see there's this vacuum cell, there are these lasers coming in. And what's going on in that vacuum cell is something that one could call synthetic quantum matter. Thanks to this quantum control, we are now able to really move and manipulate single atoms into these synthetic, complex quantum many-body systems. And the reason I'm pointing that out is that I want you to have a certain mindset for this talk. I think the best way to understand what we're doing is that we're treating these atom arrays as systems that are of interest in their own right. You know, there's a separate discussion we can have about how they relate to real materials, to real problems, but for now we're simply interested in them as an interesting many-body system that we have synthetically created in the lab. So that's the context we're working in. And the Hamiltonian that we're using to formally describe these atom arrays is the Rydberg Hamiltonian. I'll walk you through the three terms briefly in just a moment. The NI operators, those are just occupation operators measuring whether an excitation is present or not. And yeah, let's get into it. First term, super simple. I guess most of you are familiar with Rabi oscillations. We're just shining a laser at those atoms. We're driving them between their ground and their Rydberg state. That's an excited level of the atom. You can basically think of this as a sigma X term in a transverse field Ising model, for example. Next up, the so-called global detuning term. If we stick with a one-atom picture, then you could think of it as tuning that laser that we're shining at the atom, that we're tuning that off resonance. So it's not exactly at the kind of atomic transition frequency of the atom. It's a little detuned. But perhaps the more useful analogy to draw is in the many-body case. There it really has the effect of a chemical potential. So it's just an energy penalty for a positive detuning for more excitations, or the other way around if it's negative, of course. And then, apart from those two atom laser interaction terms, we've got one more coming from the atom-atom interaction terms. And to understand that, I thought I'd throw in a slide really about the building blocks of these systems. I said we're using atoms, but more specifically, we're using very cool Rydberg states. And those are states of this atom where the electron, or one electron, is excited very far out, almost to the ionization limit. And that gives this atom very exaggerated properties. I've listed them in this table from the Rydberg Bible by Gallagher on the left. A lot of interesting stuff. The polarizability, for example, scales as n to the 7. And that's the reason I was told these Rydberg states get used in cavity QED experiments as well. Then something that will be very important to us is the dipole moment that scales as n squared, giving rise to very strong interactions, as we'll see on the next slide. And yeah, for fun, I just put in a depiction of the orbital radius, also scales at n squared. So these are really big states. Quera, for example, uses the n equals 70 state of rubidium atoms, so 70 squared, that's almost 5,000. These are really enhanced states. And what does that now mean for that two-body interaction term in our Hamiltonian? Well, turns out that the leading electrostatic interaction between those two atoms, if you choose two atoms for the simple case, is a dipole-dipole interaction. And the important part from this first part of the slide is just that scales as 1 over r to the 3. Rest is not so important. And then you can take a certain limit. I've erred on the side of putting too much on this slide. If you take a certain limit, then you do second order perturbation theory, and that turns from r to the 3 to r to the 6. And that's why people typically talk about a van der Waals type of interaction in this Hamiltonian. And one more important thing, that interaction is super strong because of that n squared scaling that I mentioned on the previous slide. Okay, so far so good. Now we're ready to introduce the key thing that gives rise to all the complex many-body physics in this Hamiltonian, namely the so-called blockade effect. Because on the one hand, we have this Rabi term, putting the atoms into oscillation, but at the same time, the closer we move those atoms together, they feel that super strong van der Waals interaction, right? And intuitively, what that means is that within a so-called blockade radius, those atoms are going to interact such that only one is typically excited. That's the key message about the blockade radius. One can, you know, say a few more words about that, but I think that's everything we need to know for today. Put the definition of the blockade radius up there, and now we can bring back the detuning term. So as I mentioned in the title, the Rydberg phase diagram is really what we're interested in, and that is really governed by the competition between the detuning and the blockade effect. This phase diagram is parameterized by two axes. I might just steal a piece of chalk real quick. The one axis is RB over A. We typically just use dimensionless parameters. And the way these experiments typically work is you first fix a Rabi drive, and as we saw before, that fixes the blockade radius, right? That was given mostly by the omega. And we can think of that as this physical length scale. And now we have one more free parameter. That's the A, the lattice spacing over here. And that just means that we can choose how far to move the atoms together, right? So we can either choose to put two atoms, let's say, in that blockade radius, so only one of them experiences the blockade effect, or we can, you know, move them closer together. Then more of them will experience the blockade effect. And then, you know, we still got the detuning that I've labeled as this big delta before. Here it's a small delta. Now, if you've already been looking more at this diagram, you might have been wondering what those words are. Let's say checkerboard. Unsurprisingly, it looks like a checkerboard. Those are the types of ordered phases of matter that are typical for this phase diagram. So this phase right here, that kind of sits down here at low RB over A values. And just to give you some intuition for what's going on here, I'll show you some more phases as we move upwards along that RB over A axis, keeping delta over omega fixed. So the next phase is typically the striated phase. As you can see, we've still kept a similar pattern on these rows, but introduced quantum fluctuations, kind of delocalized electrons on the alternating rows. That just further optimizes the energy configuration. And as we move further up, next comes the star phase, for example. So that's just to give you an intuition. And I should mention that that phase diagram is taken from Ryan Samajdar's paper. They did a DMRG study on that. And the further up we go, the more open the phase diagram becomes. But those are also the three phases that we were mostly interested in studying so far. And one more point to make is, I think this was already mentioned in a previous talk today, this phase diagram is not just theory, but those phases were really observed in experiment. This is, again, taken from that seminal paper from Harvard with Sepper Ebadi. As you can see, similar areas of that phase diagram as before, with the checkerboard, the striated, and the star phase. So we've got experiment, we've got DMRG, as I pointed out, that was the technique used for the previous plot. There's been recent work using novel tensor network methods, tree tensor networks. And finally, there's also quantum Monte Carlo. And there has been previous work on that, but we've just tried using stochastic series expansion. Since it's a short talk, I'm not going to focus much on quantum Monte Carlo. I kept this essence of QMC slide, just in case people here are not familiar at all. A few words, Monte Carlo in general, used to solve challenging problems involving probability distributions by not treating it exactly, but just sampling from that distribution. We can either sample completely randomly, or we can use something like Markov chain Monte Carlo, generating a chain of samples, which turns out to be more efficient, but you get correlation. And so I'll skip over this because I think people in the room are probably quite familiar with this. And maybe just two comments on quantum Monte Carlo. Again, it's a classical method, does not run on quantum hardware, and it is an umbrella term. So the specific technique that we used was this stochastic series expansion, originally invented by Anders Sandvik. I think he's at Boston University right now. And it was adapted by EJAZ to that Rydberg-Hamiltonian. So go check out his paper, or go check out Blockade. Blockade, that's the open source platform used by Quera for simulation and computation. You can learn a lot about Rydberg systems there, and you can even try addressing the actual quantum hardware through this platform. So there's a tutorial there, and I'll leave the technical details at that. So that we have more time to talk about the results. And for that, I should first tell you, how do you really detect these phases? We've seen this real space density pattern, But, right, if there's a pattern, there's a more efficient, compact representation of that data. We can take a Fourier transform. And if we look at the two-point function, for example, we see these peaks emerging. In the checkerboard case at pi-pi, and the rotated counterparts of that. So that's really what the order parameters for these phases are. You can do a similar thing for the striated case and the star case. Just a subtlety in the literature, people typically have been using the one-point function. It's pretty much the same plot. You still have those strong peaks, and then just the self-correlation, so to speak, at 0, 0. We won't care about that. It's just that pi-pi in the corner. And for the other phases, we get an extra peak at 0 pi for the striated phase. And then for the star phase, pi-pi disappears, 0 pi stays, and we get an extra one at pi-half pi. So that's really what we're looking for. So what did we find? Well, firstly, the checkerboard phase, I plugged in the same parameter values from before, worked very nice, both in the real space plot as well as the Fourier transform. Striated phase also worked wonderfully. We even saw those nice quantum fluctuations that I pointed out earlier. But the star phase, that didn't work quite so well. I was still using this value of RB over A equals to 1.6 that was used in that paper by Ryan Samajdar. But instead of the star phase, we saw this pattern, which I guess one could call perhaps a striated phase without those quantum fluctuations. So what is going on? We're not fully sure yet, but we have the hunch that this might be due to ergodicity issues that are currently present in our QMC. And to understand that, yep, I've put up the phase we'd actually be hoping to see, the star phase. As you can see, kind of similar, but the alternating rows, they're shifted over by one. And what we think might be the case is that these two phases are not separated by a huge energy difference. This on the left might still be a local minimum, but the reason the QMC might struggle with this is that even though it looks like a simple change, it does involve a global spin flip. You know, it's not just one spin here and one spin there that we need to flip. It's quite a global feature. And that turns out to be quite hard for the QMC. So, yeah, I guess we learned something about our method. Also, what I just said, you know, we're not fully sure about it. Ejaz has offered some more comments on that we're thinking through. That's pretty much where we're at for the phases right now. There was one more thing. We can also change to periodic boundary conditions instead of using open boundary conditions, and that's actually also what the DMARG paper implemented. And funnily enough, for 4x4, the star phase did turn up. For 8x8, we saw this similar behavior as before, where again, you know, we would just need to shift this up by one, and it does look a little promising because, you know, it's not as clearly not the star phase as before. But again, we still need to have some more discussions. And finally, since I have a few more minutes today than on Friday, I threw in a little bit of experimental data from this new processor. For context, Aquila is a 256 neutral atom qubit machine. It operates currently in the analog mode, which just means that instead of discrete gates, we have continuous control parameters. So that delta, that omega, those are really the parameters that you tune. And the Hamiltonian you can think of as one big multi-qubit gate. Aquila is working towards digital mode as well, because that's universal and this is not. But currently the analog mode is a very promising route towards quantum simulation and hence also perhaps useful quantum advantage. Another key word that Quera likes to use is that Aquila is a field programmable qubit array, FPQA. I'll explain that on the next slide. and very importantly, can be accessed by you through AWS Ket. You can get research credits and actually send programs to this machine. So what does FPQA mean? It's just expressing one key thing, really, namely that the atoms can be moved using optical tweezers. And that is a key advantage of this architecture in contrast to superconducting qubits, let's say. There, you know, your qubits are literally fixed, you fabricated them. But here you can move them. And that means that it's amazing for a quantum simulation. You can put the atoms in a square lattice. You can rearrange them into a Kagame lattice. If you want to do some real-world optimization, you can have a world map or a lot of other stuff. And if I knew how to make animations in Beamer, I would put up the Pac-Man games that the experimentalists like to play in their spare time. So that's a key advantage of neutral atom simulators. And for this task, we, you know, just stuck with the square lattice. I thought these plots were really interesting to look at as a theorist or after having done these numerical simulations, because just made me realize, well, yeah, you know, in an experiment you get loads of defects and they're very interesting to look at. In particular, you can see this boundary pinning effect. The boundary has less constraints and it gets more noisy towards the middle, the bulk. And you know, if we then average over all the shots that are taken, again, we see the boundary is a lot clearer than the bulk. And again, here's the Fourier transform of the one-point function. And when I looked at this, that's actually when I thought, huh, well, why are those peaks so reduced in comparison to my quantum Monte Carlo simulations? And hence, I started looking at the two-point function in the first place. Because if you take out that zero-zero peak, then you really see, aha, I do have the checkerboard pattern. And yeah, we're still in the process of looking at more data from Aquila because, funnily enough, we also didn't see the star phase there, or rather, I should say, people at Quera, they just sent me the data that they ran. So they didn't see it, and now I couldn't see it in the QMC so far either. So that's been an interesting comparison that we'll keep moving through. And if I still have a very brief moment, I'll turn to one more thing we did, namely look at a phase transition. Phase transitions are described by critical exponents through the scaling hypothesis, but this, you know, holds for infinite systems. If it's a finite system, we have to modify the derivation a little bit, and we can get this explicit L dependence for observables such as the magnetization. And that's the key takeaway here. We can make that L dependence explicit. And furthermore, you can introduce another quantity called the Binder cumulant. It has a nice property, namely, it involves this ratio of the order parameter. In our case, the staggered magnetization. I realize I didn't put that up here, but it's just the alternating sum of the spins. And the spins are related to the occupation just by subtracting off a half. It's just to be able to talk about things in a familiar language. The key point is that this ratio makes this L dependence at the front drop out, because we have m to the 4 and m squared squared, so that L dependence disappears and we are only left with the L dependence inside that scaling parameter. And if you just believe that that's useful and look at this plot, then you can use it to find the critical point. That's pretty cool. Right, if I just go back briefly, you see at the critical point, this vanishes. So if you compute U4 for different system sizes, they will intersect at the critical point. And using this method, the value we extracted was, as you can see here, 1.06. In the literature, it's a bit higher at roughly 1.12, but for now, due to the rather small system sizes that I ran this on, it's a first good test that our QMC is working. And then the second step is that we can also extract critical exponents. through this idea of data collapse. If you use the right critical exponent, for example, nu, that governed the behavior of, for example, the magnetization, then you can extract a critical exponent. And again, it was not exactly the same as a literature value. If you look here, 0.8 versus 0.6. But you know, this value also came with error bars, and we still believe, given the small system size, that it's a good first test of the QMC. Final slide. How does this relate to something useful, or perhaps something that goes beyond classical methods? Well, a first next step for us is that we'll move from the square lattice to the so-called Chasti-Sutherland lattice, which introduces frustration into the model. And that will be a real ergodicity stress test for our QMC. And if we improve on the algorithm using those insights that we had from these first phase simulations, then we hopefully can tackle this with both QMC and Aquila. But then we can also do something beyond QMC, namely take a different limit. If you remember, I just snuck in there that in the derivation of that r to the 6, we have a certain limit. If you take a different limit, you get a different Hamiltonian, a Heisenberg Hamiltonian, and that does have a sign problem if you have anti-ferromagnetic interaction on the off-diagonal. So there we might not be able to use QMC anymore, and if we benchmark Aquila well, it might lead us to new frontiers. And finally, just a brief hint, something I find really fascinating, our so-called analog with UE experiments, where you map the Hilbert space, the dynamics of this neutral atom quantum processor to entirely different things, such as hadronization processes. They're cool papers by collaborators out recently, studying like Lundstring models, and yeah, just a lot of cool stuff where you can think of these machines not just as computers, but really as experiments by analogy. And there's a great book on that by a physicist and a philosopher of science. And if you're interested, I can point that out to you. So I think that's it. Thank you for listening. And if you have any questions, happy to answer.
Thanks a lot, Anna. We have time for one question, I think.
Thanks, Anna. So for the preparation of the ground state in this Aquila machine, do they use adiabatic? What's the procedure?
Yeah, so it's a ramp they use, it wouldn't be adiabatic state preparation.
I see. So do you think that will cause the problem that you don't see this stride phase, such a basically
the star phase, the strided phase is
fine. Yeah, the star phase.
I mean, it might be. I haven't looked at that data very much, so I don't really know right now what the defects look like and whether. Well, actually, I think I did have a look, and it did look very similar to the QMC. Again, kind of the strided phase without fluctuations. I'm not sure, to be honest, because I haven't worked with experimental data very much, so I don't quite know their perspective on why they didn't find the star phase.
Okay. Yeah, I think looking at the time, we have to finish at this point.
Yeah. One final thing, just briefly. I haven't fully finished it, but there's a nice initiative. I think this is not based on my simulations or so on, but it's just a GitHub repo where you can include in your papers or your talks, how much CPU power or QPU power you used. And I mean, it doesn't solve climate change by any means, but it gives you an order of magnitude for how much energy you use and how much travel actually consumes. So it's more a good order of magnitude estimate. So I hope physicists like it. Yeah.
Okay, thanks, Anna. And now we are done the official programming for this conference for the day. And you're all welcome to stay here in the theater for Neil Turek's colloquium, which is starting basically in 15 minutes. But also, as yesterday, the bar is open, so you decide. And let's thank all of the speakers again today for a wonderful day. Thank you.